I should watch my back. I'm gonna end up with like a V8 engine in my bed beside me, just grease everywhere.
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show all about the future of transportation. I'm Patrick George, editor-in-chief of Inside EVs.
And I'm Tim Levin, senior editor at Inside EVs. On this week's show, Ram canceled its electric pickup truck, but was that its best decision in years? And Tesla is under fire for its flush electronic door handles after a bombshell investigation. Plus, stick around for my conversation with Joe Cohen, CEO of a very cool mobility startup called Infinite Machine. We talk about the future of e-bikes and why it's so important to get people out of their cars, even when they're electric. It may sound like odd coming from InsideEVs.com, but you know, we love e-bikes out here, and we know that big electric trucks, as we'll talk about later in the show, are not the answer for everybody.
Yeah, that's dangerous thinking in the American auto industry, Tim. You're saying not everybody should drive around in like a full size pickup truck. I don't know what's next, man. Collective farming, full send communism. Is that what you want, Tim? Is that what you want?
I should watch my back. I'm gonna end up with like a V8 engine in my bed beside me, just grease everywhere.
Yeah, things are different now in America. You got to watch what you say, Tim. How are you? You doing good? You feeling good today? As we stand, do you have air conditioning? Because I don't. In this glass case of emotion that I'm in at the New York office, because we're working on budgets for the year, and the budget might include a podcast studio, but it might not until it does.
Here we are. Heat therapy is good for you, Patrick. Sauna.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll relax you.
Yeah. We'll do this podcast until I pass out in here. It'll be great. Let's jump right into it. So one defining trend that we're going to be talking about a lot over the next few months is what the American EV market looks like when the tax credits go away, which, by the way, that happens on September 30th, i.e. like 2 weeks from now, less than that, in fact. So get those deals while you still can. But in anticipation of a slowdown in electric sales, we're already seeing a lot of automakers back off on their future EV plans here in America. The latest example is Ram, which recently said it's going to cancel its all-electric truck entirely.
Yeah, that would be the Ram 1500 REV. It was supposed to be Ram's first all-electric truck and a competitor to the Ford F-150 Lightning and the Chevrolet Silverado EV and a handful of others. And it was going to be another big battery truck, 168 kilowatt hours for the base model.
Dear God, man, we're going to need a special lithium mine just for all of America's electric pickup trucks.
Right. And that's part of the problem, as we'll get into. And that comes actually after Ram canceled plans to offer an even larger 229 kilowatt hour battery.
Dear God. And by the way, for the record, that would have been like not only the largest EV truck battery on sale, but I think probably the largest battery on sale. Like that's scientifically, it's ginormous. It's like 3.5 like Tesla Model Y batteries.
Something like
for context.
That.
Yeah, it's huge. It's insane. But the range would have been good, right?
Yeah. So that would have been good for 500 miles of range. That's kind of when Ram first came out with this truck or first announced it and showed it off a few years ago, they were like, this is going to have 500 miles of range, way more than any of the other electric trucks that were going on sale or were announced.
Yeah.
That not as huge battery would have been 350 miles, which is kind of middle of the road in the EV truck space these days. You have Chevy Silverados that are getting like almost 500 miles of range.
Yeah, well north of 400 on those. They do really well at that.
Yeah, 493 is the top one.
Wow.
And then on top of that, this truck just got delayed several times. You know, it made sense, right? This was in the US, you have like the big truck kings are Chevy Silverado and the like GMC Sierra, Ford F-Series, and then the Ram 1500. And that's like makes up a huge amount of America's car sales, but it got delayed a bunch of times. It was supposed to go on sale in 2025, then it was pushed to 2026, then it was pushed to 2027, and now it is no more. It is not happening anymore.
Yeah, I think RAM had been getting nervous about this thing for a while. And it's really important to consider the backdrop under which all this is happening. Because I feel like company cancels an electric crossover. Like, that's a bummer. You're backing off on your EV strategy, whatever. This is a bit of a different animal in my book. And there's a lot of things at work here. First of all, like, RAM's parent company, Stellantis, has been having a real bad time lately. I'm going to keep this brief, but Stellantis is the shotgun marriage of Fiat Chrysler and France's PSA Peugeot Citroën. And when that happened, the company sort of decreed that the future would be all electric, which, great, whatever. But in doing so, Stellantis jacked up the prices of some of its most profitable brands, especially here in America, like Ram and Jeep, and didn't give them much in the way of new product. That's why there was a run where gas Jeeps were like $100,000 and nobody understood why and no one was buying them.
Right. And now everybody's mad.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. When the old CEO of Stellantis was like left slashed, was ousted. Everyone was mad at him. Like the unions, the dealers, the employees, the Jeep and Ram fans, like that. Like everyone was mad at that dude. So now Stellantis is in like comeback mode, sort of. But when you add in things like tariff costs, you know, the situation gets even worse. And then you add in the fact that EV trucks have not taken off the way that they were once projected to.
Right. This is arguably the toughest segment to take electric. It's also, like I said, this is the bread and butter for a company like Ram, is these big trucks. So if you're going to go electric, that's what you're going to do. And you need a huge battery to meet those range and towing requirements of an electric truck. We've talked about this before. It means that you have a ton of extra weight. You have a ton of extra cost because you need this 200 plus kilowatt hour battery just to be able to go like the few hundred miles that people want in their electric truck and to have any hope of like towing anything, towing your boat, right? It's going to slash range by like half. And so you need to have this gigantic battery to make up for that. It's a really tough sell for people who really like trucks. And for that reason, like everybody kind of thought that electric trucks were going to take off, right? You electrify America's best-selling segment and boom, like you're off to the races. That has not really happened. As of August, Ford sold about 19,000 Lightning trucks.
Yeah, which sounds great until you realize that in that same time period, Ford has sold about 500,000 gas-powered F-Series trucks. So, yeah.
Right. And this is like my favorite stat that probably Ford wants everybody to forget, which is that the F-150 Lightning launched in 2022, spring of 2022. And in the run-up to that, they were saying that they were getting all these reservations, refundable reservations, which it turns out didn't quite pan out. They're getting all these reservations, and they were like, we have to make more trucks. So at first, they were going to make 40,000 a year. Then they doubled that to 80,000 a year. And then they doubled that again, like a few months later, to 150,000 capacity. They were like, we're going to build out capacity for Ford F-150 Lightnings to 150,000 trucks a year. And then you fast forward to now, and like we said, through about half of this year, they sold 19,000. Last year, they did like 30-something thousand. So they still haven't even hit like the baseline of what they thought they were going to sell a few years ago. And so, yeah, it takes a lot to replace the gas pickup truck with EV. You need to sell a ton of them. And for a variety of reasons, that is just not happening.
Yeah. And like, this is like mission critical for the American automakers, like, you know, Tesla accepted, right? Mm-hmm. They make their bones on pickup truck sales, like Ram, Chevrolet, GMC, Ford, like anything else they make is just salad dressing for them. But like, they're truck companies, and if they're not buying electric trucks, like that's an existential crisis. So we get why. And in light of that situation, the Ram 1500 is dead, RIP. But not Ram's electrification initiatives. There's another and ostensibly more exciting truck coming, the Ram Ramcharger. And this is an EREV, or extended range electric vehicle. You've probably heard about this before. It's like a battery EV truck with a gas V6. And all that does is recharge the battery. It does not drive the wheels. It's just a generator for your battery. This is a really, really interesting concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is. So the Ramcharger is living on. This is really confusing. The Ram Charger name is not. So they are renaming the Ram Charger, the EREV truck, to be the Ram 1500 REV, which was the name of the full electric one. So Ram's coming out with a full electric truck next year. Or sorry, not a full electric. Ram is coming out with its electrified truck next year. It is called the Ram 1500 REV, and it's an extended range EV.
Yeah. So to recap, Ram 1500 REV.
Confused people even more, Patrick.
It's dead. Then the range extended one, the Ram Charger, it lives, but it's being called the Ram REV now, which
Thank
is,
you.
Yeah, it, utterly confounding. And I think I like $10 says like they're just going to come out with like the name Ram Charger is real badass. I think we'd all agree.
So I know
it's going to be like some Hemi V8 special. Like it's just going to be like a pure gas, like Hellcat engine truck or something. That's what they'll use it for. But yeah,
probably. The way things are going, probably. So the 2026 Ram 1500 REV, the EREV, will offer 145 miles of electric range from a battery that's around 90 kilowatt hours. It'll also have a gas tank and the ability to fill that up. And so in total, Ram says you'll be able to go 690 miles between stops, assuming your bladder can actually handle that. So it's kind of like, in a lot of ways, I mean, I'm really interested to try these things out because I am too young to be part of the EV world that included like the Chevy Volt and the BMW i3, which were kind of earlier versions of this, arguably ahead of their time. So I'm really curious to see what an EREV is like.
We, like well over a decade ago at Jalopnik, me and a photographer friend took a BMW i3 with the gas range extender out of Austin, like into the hill country for photos, like we always did. And like really amazing car, groundbreaking, kind of like found a cult following later, the i3, but like don't drive it out of a city because it has like no gas tank at all. And I remember we were stopping like every other gas station just to keep the battery charged. Like it was a European city car, man. Like it wasn't built for, you know, Texas driving, but the Ram REV.
Yeah. And it has like bicycle tires on it.
But the Ram REV, now we're doing it right, baby. Yeah, you know.
Right. It's a really interesting idea. So it's like you have the battery that you can like do your around town trips, 100 something miles, you can go get groceries or whatever, and then when you go on that long road trip, you can fill it up with gas, and then that gas charges the EV part of it. Which makes sense. And so we had a story this week from Mac Hogan that I really liked. He is both an EV guy and a truck guy, and he wrote a smart piece about this where he basically argued like this was the right decision. Ram was right to cancel the electric truck in favor of the EREV. So, I mean, what do you think about that? What do you think about, was this the right move for Stellantis and for Ram, even though like we're the EV website and we think that EVs are the future? I think most people recognize that that is the long-term future.
Yeah.
What do you think about this move?
I'm super mixed on it. I mean, like pragmatically, like I totally get why this happened for all of the reasons we've talked about, from sales to just like, I'm personally, even though I'm a fan of the Lightning, I really enjoy that truck a lot. And I personally love the Rivian R1T. It's probably what I'd buy for myself if I had, you know, $95,000 to spend on an electric truck, which to date I don't. But like, I get that it's this big battery truck approach is really problematic, and it doesn't really work for most people. Like with the range, towing, hauling sacrifices you make, it's all before you get into just the sheer amount of natural resources it takes to, you know, make one of those batteries and to charge them. Like I charged a Silverado EV at my house last month, and like my wife is still not talking to me about our electric bill. Like it's crazy how much juice it takes to power those things. Like I don't think it's a great solution. Like in the near term, probably hybrid trucks are more promising. It's why Ford sells like a bazillion hybrid F-150s. Like, okay, cool. More power to them. My question is, can they pull off this EREV? Like, will people know how to use it? Will the dealers know how to sell it? Like, this is, you know, it's another thing for people to learn, and like it has to be plugged in, and you know, it's got the added complication of a gas engine. Like, this is just something really different that our market has never seen before. I'm also really interested in like, what's the fuel economy of that engine going to be, and like, what's the CO2 output going to be? Like, if all it does is recharge the battery, and not drive the wheels. I have to assume it's going to be way better on both than like a gas truck would be, but we don't know yet.
Yeah, well, we actually do know.
We actually
Ram,
do know.
Ram has told us that the Ram Charger, former Ram Charger, God, that's going to take me a while. The Ram 1500 Rev, the EREV, is going to get about 20.5 miles per gallon when the battery is drained, which is like not that good. It's actually like kind of pretty comparable to gas or hybrid trucks. So the real big benefit is like over time, you know, you can use that, you can use the electric power and that gives you the fuel economy benefits.
Yeah. And which actually the tracks with like the i3 I drove all those years ago, it's like it really kind of sucked if you had the battery dead and depended on the gas engine. Like it kind of does seem like the way to run these trucks is keep the battery at a decent level and that gas engine just keeps giving you more range that you need to go. But we're going to see how people like adapt to that. This is really different.
Because then essentially you're a V6 truck dragging around a 90 kilowatt hour battery that weighs a ton. And so that's why your fuel economy is not so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I largely agree with you. I'm less mixed. Like I think it was the right decision to cancel this truck. I mean, they had, you know, everybody's been ragging on Stellantis for not moving quickly enough on EVs. The only ones they've now rolled out a few of them. But they had kind of accidentally, just by like dragging ass on this stuff, they ended up having the luxury of being able to see, okay, how did the F-150 Lightning do in the marketplace? How did the Silverado EV and GMC Hummer EV and GMC Sierra and Rivian, like how are these things doing? And they are not putting up the numbers that trucks we'd expect from trucks. And so they're like, yeah, like screw that. Like we're going to go with this. We're going to take a bet on this EREV at least, and set aside that electric one because it's just not the time. People don't want it. I think the problem is the regulations and the policies. Like a couple of years ago when this was announced, you had EV tax credits that you could depend on. And so maybe a truck buyer who wouldn't love, you know, maybe they'll be pushed to buy this kind of EREV because they're like, oh, well, I can choose between the regular gas one or the EREV. The EREV gets me $7,500 back, so I'll buy the EREV.
Right.
That's not going to be the case next year.
Value prop now? Why buy that over another Ram?
Right. Yeah. And same thing is true of the California waiver, right? Like this California-specific EV sales mandates that were going to affect over time that a bunch of other states were following. You could satisfy those as a manufacturer if you sold plug-in hybrids, and that included EREVs. So even when the hammer would come down in, 2035, and you couldn't sell gas-powered cars anymore, you could still sell plug-in hybrids like EREVs. And so that was kind of like future-proofing the Ram truck for that. Now neither of those things exist, so I don't know. I think it's going to be a challenge to convince people why they should buy this. I think it's cool, but I'm a freaking nerd about this stuff. Why is a truck driver in, you know, the middle of America going to buy it? That's something that Ram and its dealers are going to have to figure out.
Yeah. And like we've covered several studies that show Americans are really interested in EREVs or excited about EREVs, which is great until you realize that none exist right now. Like it's a growing market in China. And besides like the Chevy Volt or the i3, which have been dead for years, that's not real. It's imaginary stuff. So, like, I'm really excited about getting super shredded abs and becoming a champion MMA fighter at 41 next year. It's the same level of, it's all conceptual. You know what I mean? Like, it's made up until we see it.
It's exactly the same as that.
Yeah. That will happen. It will happen. Yeah.
Shifting gears.
Let's talk door handles, baby.
Yeah. Door handles. So if you've taken an Uber in any major city recently, you probably know what I'm talking about. Lots of people are finding Tesla's sleek, flush-mounted door handles annoying to open. But these door handles may also present a real danger in a crash. And this is a pretty serious story. The U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, as we call it, opened an investigation into 174,000 Model Ys from the 2021 model year after seeing several reports that their electronic door handles could fail to open when they don't get enough power from the 12-volt battery. And that could be in the event of a collision or seemingly just randomly when the battery dies.
Yeah, and I want to clarify, there's kind of two things at work, and they're kind of the same, but also not. We're talking about an electronic system in the car, not a mechanical linkage, but an electronic system that operates the door handles, and also those annoying little handles that like are flush against the car and aren't just like the ones you grab or like pull up like on any other car. And like sometimes they're the same thing, sometimes not, but like this is a very common feature on EVs. Mm-hmm. It started with Tesla. I would argue just by virtue of Tesla's sales volumes, it's probably the most pervasive example of this out there. And this kind of goes back to like, how do you make an EV that's affordable? And like, you know, because batteries are super expensive and Tesla pioneered all these ways, like top to bottom, how do we streamline car making? How do we cut parts? How do we reduce cost and complexity overall? You know, stuff that the other car companies are trying to figure out. That this is one area where they may have taken things too far, just like depending solely on electronic locks to release the doors. And also like those, they're flush against the door for aerodynamic reasons, because that helps with range too. So it's a couple of design issues that are coming together here. This got highlighted in a big Bloomberg investigation recently. I'll let you fill people in on what that said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good distinction. We're mostly talking here about the electronic aspect, the fact that these operate without a normal mechanical kind of system.
Right.
And so there was this big Bloomberg story where reporters identified at least 140 complaints to NHTSA about Tesla doors not opening or malfunctioning. The story describes situations when first responders couldn't open Tesla doors from the outside after a crash. They're trying to save people. Situations where children were stuck inside because the battery died and the adults couldn't open the door from the outside.
Jesus.
And there were people who died or were burned very badly because of this.
Because it's horrifying.
A Tesla crashed. They have these very, like, EV fires are, I think, an overblown issue, but when it does happen, it can be very, very serious. And so, like, these people are trying to get out. Their car is, like, bursting into flames, and people can't save them. And so the whole problem, as Bloomberg paints it, is that, like we said, these Tesla door handles are totally electronic, so you can't just run over and just rip it open if the car loses power. And there are mechanical releases inside, but they can be hard to find, or in some cases, in some cars, in some places in the car, they just don't exist. Some of these situations were in Cybertrucks, which don't have door handles at all. They have a button that just pops the door out. So, I mean, this is a serious situation. It's hard to know exactly how widespread it is. Like you said, Tesla pioneered this, but there are others that, there are other companies that also use this sort of system. What's your read here, Patrick? Do you think that this crackdown on these kinds of door handles is warranted? Do you think, you know, Tesla and some of these other companies, like you said, took things a little too far?
I mean, the stories of the crashes and the deaths of these things you mentioned, it's one of the most horrifying things I've ever heard of. Like, I mean, that's just, imagining your family being stuck in that situation is just like an unimaginable nightmare. I mean, I have a lot of thoughts here, and I think this is just kind of like, this is sort of the stuff that that gets learned the hard way when you're trying to reinvent something that's worked a certain way for a century. And I mean, that's like, oh, cost of doing business. Not at all. It's just like, okay, this seemed like an okay idea in practice, but when you put it into the field, into real use, it has like tragic and deadly consequences. And I think it shows that maybe not everything needs to be rethought. And like, some things work because they just work, like a door handle. And I mean, this is endemic to a lot of EVs, whether it's the electronic release or just like annoying design that makes it tough to get them open. Like, it's like this stuff worked the way it did for a reason. I also think, you know, you mentioned at the outset there has been one issue where like these doors would not open when the 12-volt battery was not sending enough juice to the car or it lost power. A lot of people don't realize this, but an electric vehicle has a traditional 12-volt battery like any car does. Mm-hmm. And that operates a lot of critical functions. Windshield wipers, locks especially, some basic stuff. And a lot of these automakers have had trouble like keeping the battery charged, right? Because on a gas car, your 12-volt battery is recharged by your engine, which doesn't exist here. And so You know, thankfully, this has never happened to my car, but like the Hyundai Motor Group EVs have had a lot of problems with that. So it's, I don't know, it is really horrible that this has led to so many accidents and injuries and fatalities in some cases, just because it's like a novel thing that's being tried out ultimately to save costs on these cars. And look,
do you
where
think that's what it's
things.
About? You think it's about saving cost? I see it as more just like, It looks sick. Like, this started kind of on the Tesla Model S, where the doors handles pop out. I think it just like looks cool, and it's cool when you're on the inside of the car to like, you hit this button that pops out the door instead of using like the regular old latch kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And aerodynamics.
And aerodynamics that give the car a little bit more range. I never saw it as a cost cutting thing.
I think it can be both, right? And it's like we hear all these stories, these car companies are just going top to bottom, trying to, what can we cut out? Like miles of wiring in the Ford Mustang Mach-E, for example, that makes them like, this is why they're getting like trashed by China on EV profitability. It's like all these things you got to do to rethink how a car gets made because batteries are so goddamn expensive. Like, it's just, you know. I think that's part of it, and there are going to be some real lessons here. I guess the last thing I'd say is, like, if Tesla gets forced into a recall situation with this, it's a lot of cars would have to be fixed this way, and this doesn't sound like a software update to me. I'm obviously not a software engineer or a Tesla employee, but, like, I don't think this is something you could just do with an OTA update, right? I mean, this sounds like work on the car to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with you there, and it's interesting you mentioned Ford. Ford is one that... Yeah. I believe they did have a recall that had to do with, they have this sort of system and the doors would get stuck sometimes and they couldn't open. So it's definitely not Tesla. Tesla's not the only one here. I think you're right. I think this is one of those situations where, like, the regulations may be a bit behind where the companies are going, a bit behind where the technology is.
In America, no. But we're so good at regulating things like social media and AI and so on. And headlamps, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it'll be another 20 years before somebody actually does anything about this.
yeah.
But China, for example, is reportedly considering a ban on these kinds of flush door handles. We could see these kinds of regulations change in the U.S., I think. Or I think that one thing that might also be likely is just it becomes kind of an accepted practice because... safety bodies, you know, agencies like NHTSA, places like Consumer Reports or IHS, like, they say you can only get a high safety rating if you have this kind of door handle that's like, makes it easy to open in the event of a crash, makes it easy for people to get out. This is another way to kind of push car companies in that direction. And I'll bring up, like, this is kind of what's happening in Europe, not with door handles, but with other stuff. Starting next year, if a car company wants to get the top 5-star NCAP rating, they need to have physical buttons for certain critical functions like the hazards or the windshield wipers, so that you're not like distracted looking at your screen when you're going down the road and, you know, crashing into stuff. So you could totally see the same thing happening in Europe or in the US.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the buttons. It's just like, it's the same thing. It's like this future-facing feature maybe wasn't the right way to go just for safety reasons and how people work and operate. But
Yeah, interesting stuff. We'll see how it turns out. So just after we finished recording, we got a fresh update in the Tesla doors saga that I wanted to add here. On Wednesday, Bloomberg interviewed Tesla design chief Franz von Holzhausen and asked him about the door handle issue, and he actually gave kind of an interesting response. He said Tesla is working on a new door release design that would combine the electronic and manual releases into a single lever. He said combining them, quote, makes a lot of sense, so that when people's muscle memory kicks in a, quote, panic situation, they can grab that lever and just pull a little farther for the emergency mechanical release. So basically, the same handle that you use in your daily life is going to be the one that you also use in an emergency. It's worth noting that Franz is talking about the interior door releases of the car, whereas the NHTSA investigation that we're talking about is into the exterior door handles. But still, this is interesting stuff here. It's notable that Tesla is working on a new design. And maybe it's even more notable that Tesla has actually decided to talk to the press about it. That is something Tesla does very, very rarely. And with that, let's get back to the show. Here is my interview with Infinite Machine co-founder and CEO, Joe Cohen. This was a really fun conversation. Just one word of warning. Joe gets pretty animated and fired up here about his company and about the future of mobility. He drops more than a few F-bombs, so if you've got kids in the car, there is your warning. So we talk a lot about electric cars on this show, but not everybody needs a car or can afford one, arguably, and this will probably make a lot of people mad. Arguably, a lot of people be better off riding something that's a lot smaller, a lot more efficient, something like an e-bike or an electric scooter. Frankly, I think these are probably the best way to get around most cities like New York. So here to talk to me all about the world of micromobility is Joe Cohen, founder and CEO of Infinite Machine, a New York City-based startup making some very interesting electric bikes and scooters. Thanks for being on the show, Joe. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
Yeah, so first off, I mean, I want to get into kind of, you know, your products, which I think are very interesting, kind of your broader strategy here. But start me off from the beginning. Like, what is Infinite Machine? When were you founded? What was kind of the driving force behind, like, hey, I should start an e-mobility company?
Infinite Machine exists to make the best personal electric vehicles on Earth and really to rethink how people get around cities and other environments where a car is not the best way to get around. And so when we look at this category that's sometimes known as micromobility or non-cars or PEVs, we see a burgeoning, exploding category that from a market perspective is growing by leaps and bounds every year. It's a $200 billion a year market today. It's going to be a $500 billion market by the end of the decade. At the same time, we see a market that has not consolidated around definitive products and whose average product is quite low quality and undifferentiated. We see a lot of commodity product that's out there. Mm-hmm. And we believe that where this market will go is to a place that looks more like the car market, actually, where you have iconic brands that represent the pinnacle of technology, engineering, design. And at Infinite Machine, we want to represent that. We want to kind of acknowledge what's happening in this category, stand on the shoulders of the players in the space currently, but bring it to a whole other level. And so that's what we're about. We want to make the best non-car vehicles and really push the envelope of what they can be. And we're starting with two products. One is P1, which is a high-performance seated scooter. And the other is Alto, which is our take on an e-bike. They're mm-hmm. both in mass production this month. And they are the foundation in which we're building our business. And also, the way we think about this is we're outside of building a single vehicle, we're building a vehicle creation platform, a way to create vehicles rapidly and at the top end of quality, the top end of technology for a fraction of the cost that it would take for a traditional, for example, automotive manufacturer to do something in this way.
Mm-hmm. And so going back to like kind of the market and where you see this company fitting in and differentiating, like, is it safe to say that basically, you know, when you say that there aren't really differentiated products or really super high quality products, it's kind of like the e-bike space is born out of, you know, most of the ones that you can buy are basically like, it's a bike with a motor and a battery that was kind of like slapped onto it in a sense, versus like your approach is how do we go from the ground up and make these kind of two-wheeled vehicles that are more kind of deliberately engineered. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, our approach is we first look at the use case. So the user and what their needs are. So for example, I want to drop my kids off to school. I want a better way to get to work in a city like New York. I want to get around my college campus. So that's number one, like understanding needs at the ground level and who the customer is and what would, you know, work for them. And then we look at the law and take the Venn diagram of needs and law. And then we look at technical capabilities and say, okay, given the constraints of the legal framework, given the needs of our user, what is the best possible product that we can make? And we don't really think about what exists. Mm-hmm. We really think from the ground up on first principles, how we can solve that problem in the best way possible. So for example, with Alto, it is classed as an e-bike. It's a class mm-hmm. 2 e-bike, but it shares no parts with e-bikes. Mm. It's ground up, designed from scratch to be the ultimate bike lane vehicle. Now, in some ways, it's overbuilt for the use case. Like, we're using effectively motorcycle and automotive grade components for a thing that most of the time is going to go 20 miles per hour. That's exactly the point. You know, if you think about a traditional e-bike, basically the model there is the opposite. They're taking bicycles, which were designed not for motor power, but for human power, and they're overclocking them with motors, with batteries. And so things, for example, like the brakes wear out very quickly and they're frankly unsafe. There's no horn. There's no turn signals. There's no headlight built in. These are all things that you get for free if you use a more automotive platform, but don't exist in the current category. So yeah, to your point, most e-bikes, I mean, pretty much all of them, are retrofitted traditional bicycles. We thought about it differently. We said, what would it look like if we were designing this thing from scratch, given the constraints of the legal framework and our customers' needs? And we ended up with something that is a lot heavier duty, a lot more storage, a lot more technology, and a lot more kind of performance in the ways that you want it. So that's kind of the way we look at it. And we will take that same lens to all of the use cases around urban transportation, both, you know, for consumers and eventually commercial users as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it would be good to, you know, take people through kind of your products, right? So we start with the P1, which was revealed a couple of years ago. People might remember, it was kind of like, I feel like it was around the same time that the Cybertruck was revealed. And so there was all these headlines saying, you know, this is the Cybertruck of scooters. It has that sort of, you could see it right behind you for the people that are watching. It has this sort of really angular kind of brutalist design. I think it looks really cool. I think the Cybertruck Association is maybe not doing it justice. It's a really great looking scooter that looks really different from, and when I say scooter, I mean something like a Vespa type scooter, not a kick scooter, right? But it doesn't have that kind of cutesy look of a Vespa. It has this really like brutalist kind of badass look, frankly. So deliveries on that recently started, right? How has that been going? Kind of getting that production ramped up and everything.
Yeah, so delivery started this summer for P1. Mm-hmm. We started out slow in terms of volume, and we'll be ramping it this fall and into the next year. Just want to make sure that people have an amazing experience. And so far, the feedback has been incredible. Actually, this morning, we delivered one unit to Europe, kind of as a beachhead, and it actually went to Formula One champion Nico Rosberg.
Oh, awesome.
And he made a video about it that he posted on social today, and he was like over the moon, excited about it and happy with it. So, you know, our initial customers are absolutely thrilled, and we'll continue to roll them out this fall as well and to the new year.
Mm-hmm. So how many of them have you sold or delivered so far?
We're not sharing sales figures publicly yet, mm-hmm. But in time.
Gotcha. Cool. Have you been driving it around New York City, I imagine?
I've been dailying it since May, which has been fucking amazing. Excuse my language. Yeah, it's been... it's a dream. I'll kind of give you the origin story of the company and how we got to here. My background is not in vehicles. My background is not even in physical products. I spent the prior 10 years of my career building software. So I'm from the kind of more traditional software tech industry. And I started the company with my brother, Eddie, who is also not from the vehicle world. He built a direct consumer brand in the wellness space. Our third co-founder, thankfully, does have some training as a vehicle engineer. And so he rounds out a lot of our, holes. Mm-hmm. But the origin story of this company and product and mission is we are in New York. When I moved to New York after college, got a Vespa. A friend of mine had one, and he kind of clued me into it being a really great way to get around the city. Tried it, fell in love with it, and it felt like a cheat code for the city. Get anywhere super quickly, park anywhere, it's cheap, looked cool, it was fun. And during early COVID, so that's like 10 years into owning this thing and 5 years ago now, that Vespa got stolen. It was a gas Vespa. It's like, okay, I've had that thing for a while. Like, let me see what's out there in terms of electric vehicles. Future's going to be electric. Let's see what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Went shopping. I was completely uninspired by everything that existed in the market. You know, you had the legacy players like Piaggio doing their version of an electric Vespa, but it was kind of inferior to the gas product in every way and more expensive. And then the more native electric companies were much more on the commodity kind of low end side of the equation. I like to describe these products as like moving printers. So just, you know, they do a task, but they're not exciting you. They're not inspiring you. And
So is that kind of like the ones that we see, you know, the kind of China special, you know, no brand, maybe even scooters and e-bikes that kind of just like get the job done, but nothing incredible.
Yeah, nothing to write home about. So that was kind of the state of the market. And so I started to think, you know what? My dream vehicle does not exist. My dream vehicle for the place that I live doesn't exist. And I'm like a vehicle enthusiast. I love all kinds of things. You know, scooters, motorcycles, cars, all these things I love. And so at the time, I was living with my brother during COVID. And I was like, Ed, I think there's something we could do in this space. And he was super excited about it. He agreed. And it became our passion project during COVID. So nights and weekends, this was what we were doing. We met Zach. We met an incredible designer. And we, as a foursome, started working on this as a passion project nights and weekends. That lasted for 3 years until we built a prototype of P1 that we started to show people, and people lost their minds over it. You know, part of the thesis was, you know, scooters are really practical ways about to get around cities, but in the popular imagination, they're super lame. No one is excited about a scooter. And so with P1, we wanted to do the exact opposite. We wanted to make a scooter that was fucking exciting, that got you like jumping out of your seat, that people wanted to ride, and that kind of made you feel something, because that's the power of a vehicle. A vehicle can make you feel something at a deep emotional level. And we started to validate that thesis. People were excited about this product. People who never thought about a scooter as something that they would consider or would desire wanted it. We made an object of desire in that way. So then we're at this point where, like, we've got this thing. People want it. We started to tease it online, and it got picked up. MKBHD reviewed it. It did super well. And at this point, like, it's still a prototype and a nights and weekends project for us. So, like, we had to make a couple of decisions. Number one was...
Like, you didn't have, like, no money to actually get this thing produced in any kind of meaningful way, I'd imagine, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there were a few things. Like, number one, it had not been productionized, period. It was a prototype. Secondly, we weren't full-time on it. And so we had to make the decision, do we want to do that? And we decided that we did for a few reasons. Number one is we realized we had something amazing on our hands that we were in love with, but that other people were also in love with. And number two was that we believe that this category was ripe for a company that made iconic products and really just represented the best. And we felt we could contribute something to this world. And once we kind of checked those two boxes, we're like, okay, we're going to do this. Went full time, raised capital, started productionizing the product, you know, figured out what that entailed and hit the ground running. Fast forward now to May of 2025, a couple months ago. First two units off the factory floor, delivered to us in New York, me and Eddie's daily riders. Absolutely incredible. And you know, so basically 5 years from napkin sketch to production tooled, super high tech vehicle that I can use every day. And I'm very happy to say that it's way better than like I even hoped for at the beginning. It is an incredible product. P1 is absolutely amazing. As someone who's been riding scooters for a long time, I was somewhat worried that, like, you know, this thing has to compete with battle-tested 75-year-old franchises, and it holds up. It's fucking awesome.
That's great. Yeah. And so tell me, like, what does make it better than you could have even expected? I mean, we talked about how, you know, these products are often kind of missing something. What in the P1 kind of sets it apart from those other products?
First thing is performance. It's just super fun to ride. It's super quick. It's silent, which is exhilarating. You know, in EVs, in cars, the silence is nice. The instant acceleration is nice. It's a whole other experience on a two-wheeler when you're out in the world, because that's when you're here. Like, when you're on a gas-powered Vespo or two-wheeler, all you're hearing is the engine, right? Mm-hmm. So the sensory experience of riding our product is like you're gliding through space. The vehicle itself is super stable. Suspension's amazing, dual suspension, and it's silent. So you really feel like you're just floating, and you have that instant electric acceleration. It really is just a phenomenal driving experience. It's amazing. And that, you know, when you break it down into the details and the componentry, we're using a really big 6,000 watt motor, a really big 72 volt battery, our own custom drivetrain firmware, motor controller, and all the small things that kind of make it work. So that's performance. The second is the build and the design. So, you know, the thing obviously looks super cool, but it's made out of stainless steel in the silver one and powder coated aluminum in our black one. Like, there are no scooters that are made out of these materials. Like, it's super durable. It looks cool. And we've sweated the details. So, like, you know, there are really convenient hooks wherever you need things. The, you know, you need regulated reflectors on these vehicles. So we integrated them into the rear passenger handles. We have USB-C and A ports throughout the vehicle. We have a camera in the front and the back. There's just a bunch of niceties through and through the design that make this thing just a joy to use. And so it's like that durable and beautiful build, I'd say, is the second bucket. The third is technology. So the thing has an 8-inch touchscreen, connects to your phone. You can run Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever other system you're doing. It's got cameras in the front and the back. It's connected to the internet. The vehicle is connected to the internet. So that means that we can update it. It also means that you can track the vehicle wherever it is with GPS. You'll get notified if someone tampers with it. You also have an Infinite Machine app to control the vehicle. So you can see where your vehicle is at all times, get stats on the vehicle. You could share access with a friend. So all the things that you expect in like a Rivian or a Tesla, we're bringing to this category, which doesn't exist yet. And then the fourth bucket of things is what I call like utility and modularity. So P1 is a workhorse. You can fit two people on it. There's tons of storage throughout the system. You can mount things to it. And so it's not purely a recreational vehicle in the way that a motorcycle is on the weekends. This is a daily vehicle. This is meant for you to use to go to the grocery store, to go to work, to drop your kids off from school, whatever it is. And it's meant to work. So it's about kind of that fun factor, but also the utility factor. And when you add all those things up, that's what makes it better. And it's the integration of all these things that just results in an amazing experience in our opinion.
Yeah, no, I was going to draw the same comparison, I think, between, you know, this and a Rivian or a Tesla, where like our listeners will understand, it's like, you know, it seems like this really kind of cohesive product, right, where you have the software and you have all these thoughtful little touches that it all kind of works together, rather than being just like, you know, an e-bike or a scooter that was kind of just thrown together in the same old way.
Exactly. That's our thesis.
Yeah. And so then you launch or you reveal the Alto recently. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, this is instead of being a scooter, this is an e-bike, you know, with pedals, lower speed, lower cost at $3,500. What's the reception been like to that? Was it kind of the same level as the, you know, when you revealed P1?
Reception to Alto has been off the charts, amazing. And a lot of demand, more demand. You know, it's obviously a lower price point, mm-hmm. so it appeals to a wider audience of people, and it's made for the bike lane. So the reason, the genesis of Alto was we were working on P1, which for people who are already kind of red-pilled into the world of, you know, personal vehicles, mm-hmm. P1 is kind of like the ultimate version of it. It's fast, it's big, it's robust, you know, it's got kind of everything. But at the same time, we realized that, you know, especially in the United States, there is this explosion in popularity of e-bikes, and that you now have this alternative infrastructure that now exists, which is bike lanes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, like, could we take what we've learned from P1 and make something that works in the bike lane, that gives you the flexibility of the bike lane, the low kind of commitment and upfront costs? You don't need a registration or a license plate or insurance or any of those things, that was accessibly priced, but that had the magic of Infinite Machine in it, the technology, the user experience, the material quality, all the things that make P1 amazing. Can we bring that into a form factor that kind of, you know, blows open who can access it? That was the idea behind Alto. And I think we've hit it out of the park. It's, you know, slimmer. So it's about 10 inches wide. It's super narrow, but it is beefy. Like, the wheels and tires on Alto are motorcycle grade. They're not bicycle tires. So they're going to be able to withstand a lot more wear and tear. You've got hydraulic brakes on it. It's got a horn, mm-hmm. like a proper horn. It's got a headlight with high beams. It's got a screen built in. It's connected to the internet. It works with our app. It has a, you know, rear brake lights and turn signals. And you can fit two people on it. And there's a bunch of storage. So it's kind of like a new form factor. It's not quite a... it's not a scooter, and it's not a traditional e-bike. Even though it's classed as a e-bike, it is kind of a new thing. It's a new form factor, and that's what we kind of hope to achieve with this one, is introducing this form factor that we think is actually the best bike lane vehicle, you know, out there. And that is kind of the idea there.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of has the same similar sort of, you know, ergonomics and general form factor to the P1, where you're like sitting on this scooter type vehicle, but this one's bike lane legal. And yeah, as you were going through it, like, this is what stuck out to me when I covered your release a couple months ago, was just the laundry list of features and specs that you would not normally see from that you wouldn't think of when you think of an e-bike, right? Like, over the air updates, GPS tracking, phone as a key, and also an NFC card as a key. All these modular storage and seat options, you know, headlight, like you said, high and low beams, a steering wheel lock. I feel like a lot of this stuff was maybe born out of you getting your Vespa stolen back in the day. It was like, how do I make sure nobody's going to get this thing stolen out of their, you know, in front of their New York City apartment? You know,
we think Alto will be among the, if not the most prized possession in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's an investment. Even at that price, it's an investment. And we want people to feel comfortable that if they buy this thing, they could park it on the street and not worry about it getting stolen. And so it's designed for that. And we really went, you know, over the top in a bunch of hardware and software features to enable that. So it's virtually theft proof. And yeah, I mean, there's so many little things on this product that I could talk to you for an hour about all the details. And, you know, we really distilled it down into its minimum thing. The thing I'd say that's different than P1 in a big way is it's a much lighter and more nimble vehicle. It's meant for the bike lane. So it weighs half as much. It is, you know, less than half as wide. It is... kind of the slimmer, distilled down, you know, execution of a similar platform. But yeah, it is a vehicle that really anyone will feel comfortable riding.
Mm. Yeah. And so between like the couple of things that I didn't mention, you know, you have an optional quote unquote supercharger that can charge this thing faster than the, you know, the one that comes equipped, removable and swappable battery. What Is there anything else you'd like to add? Like, what is your favorite thing on this that you were like, why has this not been on e-bikes before? And like, I'm so proud that we get to put this thing on the Alto.
I mean, there really are a lot of things I'll call out. A few. One is kind of the smarts of it. So being able to control it with the app, track it, share access. This thing is a computer on wheels.
Mm.
That just doesn't exist. It's the difference between like a smartphone and a dumb phone in terms of, you know, Alto versus normal e-bikes.
Mm-hmm. Share access, like you can, through the app, you can give somebody else, you know, if somebody else just has a phone, they can go and unlock and drive your bike.
Let's say I'm on a vacation in Japan and you're staying at my apartment. I can give you access from wherever I am to just use my bike and have your daily commuter now as a guest in the city. Or if you're super a family cool. member or spouse or something like that. Yeah, there's no physical key. It's entirely digital. By the way, a lot goes into doing that because it also has a removable battery. So you have a removable battery and no physical key. How do you get into the battery compartment without the battery in it?
Mm.
Well, you need a backup battery. So we have an auxiliary battery in the system that keeps the system alive for 30 days, even if the main battery is not installed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say that backup battery dies. What do you do? Well, you have to have a backup port where you can charge the backup battery using a normal outlet, like an AC adapter. So these are all things we had to figure out, but it works. And yeah, that was that main thing. So that's number one, which is the smarts of it. The second I say is the modularity. Alto, even more than P1, is highly accessorizable. So we have over 20 accessories for the product. Everything from a way to carry a kid to a rear rack to the ability to have a supercharger, like I said, which will charge it 80% in 90 minutes, which is amazing. We have, another cool thing that we did was we said, okay, how about we just add mounting points to this vehicle where you can attach stuff? Because ultimately a vehicle is meant to carry people and things. So like it carries two people at least, because you can carry children. So two plus children. And then things, we want it just as many attachment points as possible. So on the rear of it, we have six heavy duty screw holes that you can attach a rear rack to or a trailer hitch. But then between your legs, like under the seat, we said, wouldn't it be cool if you could put like a water bottle? We said, oh, well, bicycles have water bottle cages. What if we just took the geometry of a standard water bottle holder from a bicycle and we put that on our design? So we have two water bottle cage screw holes, basically, so that you can attach any accessory that works with a water bottle geometry from a normal bicycle, whether that be a water bottle holder or
tons of other things.
So it's just things like that that make this thing endlessly customizable. That's the second thing. And then the third thing is, frankly, like, it looks freaking cool. It's beautiful. The thing is gorgeous. And like, I don't know, you don't want to get picked up on a date on an e-bike, but you want to get picked up on a date on an Alto. Like, it's really, really cool. It's really fun. It's beautiful, and that matters. Vehicles are highly self-expressive. They're fashion. And so we wanted to make a thing that was not, we did actually change it. The design of Alto is in some ways more restrained than P1. P1 has a very dramatic facade and fascia with our grill lighting element kind of announces its presence in a very bold way. With Alto, we actually pulled it back. We have a flush anodized aluminum fascia with no light element besides from the headlight, kind of underneath the extruded aluminum. But there's no like big grill element or something like that. That's very intentional. We wanted this product to be yours and for you to bring the personality with it and for it to be applicable in a very universal fashion. And so we really pared it down. There's no logo on the front. There's no big badge. It is kind of a tool in that way. And so, yeah. And we expect for there to be a lot of these in the world and for that to I think it worked well. You want this product to kind of fit into the world and you slip through in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so this is already, I know you said deliveries were starting this fall. What's kind of the status on whether people can actually buy and, you know, whether pre-order holders are getting their Altos?
So yeah, we opened pre-orders in June. We're continuing to take pre-orders and we're fulfilling them in the order that they're received. We're starting mass production this month and we'll ramp this fall. Customers will get vehicles, you know, most pre-orders will get their vehicles this fall and ramp from there.
Yeah, awesome. And so where are the vehicles built? Are they built in the same place?
They're both built in China. Both P1 and Alto are built in China currently. A vehicle is a product made up of 100 other products. So we have many, many sub-suppliers that are made in many, many different places, but we assemble them in China right now. Over time, we will be opportunistic and we think of the place of assembly as relatively portable depending on where demand is and the nuances of what's happening at a given moment in time from a supply chain perspective. For simplicity's sake, we partnered with very experienced manufacturers to help us scale. And they're in China.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I know that a lot of bike makers, bike brands have been slammed by tariffs in various ways just because these are pretty much all made abroad in Asia. Has that been something that you've had to deal with, the impacts of new tariffs and changing tariffs?
Yes, for sure. Look, it's not easy for any global company right now because the ground is changing quickly. With that said, we're basically absorbing the cost of those tariffs to make sure that we deliver the best product to our customers. In the future, once we have a bit more solidity on where the tariff regime shakes out, we will be strategic about where we manufacture for where it makes sense. We're going to be selling globally as well. And the tariffs are somewhat unique to the US phenomenon. So, for example, in Europe, there are not tariffs from China. Now, in India, there are, meaning if you want to import products from China into India, there are tariffs. But we don't have plans to go into that market for a while. We're very much an American company. We're based here in New York City. We are very excited about the idea of reindustrializing the United States. We think it starts with, you know, building really the first premium American brand in this category. We're in a category that's dominated by Asian and, you know, has legacy European companies, but there's not an American brand that people rattle off when they think about, making, premium automotive grade personal vehicles. Right. Mm-hmm. We're very proud of that. And as there are opportunities to do more here, we will take those opportunities. And you know, we want to be part of that story here.
Mm-hmm. And so you talked earlier about like, how do you decide, you know, what these products should be like? It's what do people need? And then how does that fit into the kind of regulatory landscape? Yeah. Like, I'd love to get your read on kind of where the laws stand for these types of vehicles, for e-bikes, because like I said, I think a lot of people think they're the best way to get around a city. And then also they're often in this kind of gray area, right? There's been a lot of backlash to e-bikes in a place like New York, where you have like delivery bike drivers, you know, going the wrong way. You have people on modded bikes that are going crazy fast. At the same time, you know, I think New York is proposing a limit of 15 miles an hour in bike lanes, and maybe that's going a little bit too far. Like, what's your kind of read on where these laws stand and maybe where they should be, if anywhere?
So we have two products and they're classed differently. So P1 has a license plate. It is considered a motor vehicle in that way. It's regulated by the federal government, by the National Highway Transport Safety Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put on that on the shelf because it's a more traditional regulatory regime that has existed for basically 100 years. Now let's look at Alto. Alto is considered an e-bike, which is not regulated by the federal government. It's regulated by state governments and local governments. There are no license plates on these vehicles. What that means is that the barrier to entry for the products is much lower for consumers, and there's a lot more innovation that is able to happen because you're not dealing with a highly regulated market.
Mm-hmm.
So that's resulted in an explosion in popularity and really a Cambrian explosion in the form factors and the creativity of these kinds of vehicles. It's kind of amazing. I would say that it's like the car industry in the early 20th century. So in the early 1900s, there were thousands of car companies in America, and they were making all these weird, interesting creations. And then they consolidated over time. And I think that will happen in this category of micromobility. So if we look at the current state of e-bike regulation specifically, there are different classes of e-bikes. So for example, there's class one e-bike, which has a certain speed limit and is pedal assist. And then there's class two e-bikes, which was adopted as a nationwide regulatory framework, even though it was implemented at the state level, that allows you to go up to 20 miles per hour with a throttle.
Mm-hmm.
That is the class that Alto fits in. And that is proving to be the most popular class and also a very responsible kind of framework. 20 miles per hour is a good limit for a bike lane. Like, we don't believe that people should be going faster than that in the bike lane. Now, New York has had a special designation called a Class 3 New York bike lane regulation, or Class 3 New York, which allows you to go up to 25 miles per hour with a throttle. There's rumor on the street is that that is going to be removed, and we're okay with that because, like I said, we think the 20 mile per hour limit is ample. Now, at the same time, when you have this burgeoning, exciting new category that's enabled by a new technology, it is a bit of the Wild West. There are all kinds of crazy things that are going too fast. And we think that that should be cleaned up. We think that the way you do this is by being responsible as an OEM, as a manufacturer of vehicles, and making smart decisions about how you do that. There are products in the market that are motorcycles, but are legally, technically considered e-bikes. We don't want to play that game.
Because it has pedals or something.
It has pedals. They threw pedals onto a thing that goes 80 miles per hour. Like, that is not responsible. We're looking at the long game. We want to be, good stewards of what the future of the bike lane could look like. And so we're fitting into that, legal envelope in a responsible manner. But yeah, look, I think we'll see where things go. We'd love to be a part of it and kind of helping to influence this. But what we've seen over time, the thing that to not lose sight of is like cities are much better and much safer when there are less cars on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Cars are these 6,000 pound vehicles and they're very dangerous. And they're not only dangerous to pedestrians, we take it for granted, but when a city, especially in America, is kind of car dominated, the people sometimes feel like second-class citizens to the car as the first-class citizen. And when you when you lower the number of cars in a city, it becomes just much more human, much more enjoyable, much more interesting, much more dynamic, much more commercial because there's more foot traffic. And cities like Paris and New York have shown us what can happen when you do that. We're really excited about that. We think cars are amazing products, but they have a time and place. And for a trip that's under 5 miles, which is the majority of trips in the United States, that is under 25 miles per hour, which is the legal limit, speed limit in New York City, you don't need a car that's designed to be moving at 100 miles per hour on the highway most of the time.
Right.
And one person,
you're usually going, right, exactly. You're usually taking just yourself somewhere.
Exactly.
You don't need the whole Chevy Tahoe, right?
Exactly. So we look at that, again, from first principles, what is the best vehicle we can design given that constraint? And it's not a car. It's this thing that's smaller, smarter, lighter. And so when we think about the regulatory environment for these non-car vehicles, we have to consider that the alternative is a car, which, again, is many thousands of pounds. Not great for the environment, even if it's electric, because there's a lot of resources that go into making a car and powering a car. Like, just one quick thing. Your average Tesla has a 90 kilowatt hour battery, right? And it's carrying one or two people in it. Alto has a 1.2 kilowatt hour pack. So it's like a 1.5% the size of a Tesla battery. It's tiny, right? Mm-hmm. But it is doing the same job a lot of the time. It's transporting one or two people. And so that's like an order of magnitude, if not two, more efficient than a car, even an electric one. And obviously the range is not the same, but still it's accomplishing a lot of the job at, you know, a much, much more efficient level.
Mm-hmm.
So we think there's a lot of benefits there for the environment as well.
Mm-hmm. With significantly fewer, you know, of those battery minerals and resources and everything.
Exactly.
So what's the future vision for Infinite Machine? When you look at products, you know, you have the scooter, you have the bike. Is it going to be mostly, you know, I guess broadly seated bike-like products? Are you looking into, you know, more like kick scooters and other things? Like, where do you kind of see the future for this company?
The next 1-2 years will be about our two franchises, P1 and Alto, and scaling those globally, having different variants of them, and really kind of, you know, satisfying the demand that exists for those products. With that said, Infinite Machine exists to make the best vehicles of all types for our users. And we will have, over the next 10 years, a full portfolio of vehicles, from everything that you can fit in a backpack to something that you can sit in.
Mm.
We're not going to make traditional cars in the classic sense, but we're very interested in new creative form factors that allow people to get around freely in all kinds of ways. And so we're going to go up and down. We're going to make bigger things and smaller things. We're not going to like make a stand-up scooter that looks like a Segway stand-up scooter, but has our logo on it. Like, we're not doing that. But we think there's a lot of innovation to be done through and through, from the smallest form factors to, you know, larger ones that can carry multiple people and or, you know, delivery and other goods. So yeah, the next 10 years for us will be about really fleshing out this portfolio. And the cool thing about that is we have figured out a way and designed a platform that allows us to do this rapidly, cost-effectively, and globally, which is very different. You know, like, there are other companies in the West that have had to raise a lot of money and spend many years trying to do a stand-up scooter, or, you know, and we, you know, we can go from sketch to mass production vehicle in a year. And, you know, so, and all of the things that we produce share the same underlying technology and system, and they compound over time. So, you know, like, one model is, you think about Apple, they have a bunch of products, but really, like, they're all flavors of the same thing, right? Like, they make a computer that fits in your pocket. It's the iPhone. They have one that you use right now, my laptop. That's the Mac. You have your iPad, which you use on the couch. You have your Apple Watch, which exists on your wrist. But they're all screens that run some version of iOS or macOS. They're all networked. They all have batteries. They all have touchscreens. So they make different flavors of the same thing. And in some ways, we're doing that. We make vehicles. They have wheels. They have batteries. They have motors. They have screens. They're connected to the internet. They have turn signals. Some platforms have features that others don't, but they kind of build on the platform. And that's ultimately what we're building. And that's the way to think about Infinite Machine. It's actually like an underlying platform that can express itself in different form factors depending on the user, the use case, and the environment.
Yeah, and when you say something that you can sit in, or delivery vehicles, like, I'm imagining neighborhood electric vehicle potentially, or kind of those, which I think are really cool, these new sort of quadricycle, you know, delivery vehicles that we see in New York City, these like Amazon little things that go in the bike lane, but it's kind of like a tiny little van. Are those kind of the lines that you're thinking along?
Yeah, we're really interested in that category. And again, we kind of like look at the intersection of needs and legal frameworks. And so, yeah, we think there's a lot there. And we think that there are opportunities to make a platform that could change its form such that it can maybe sit in more than one of those frameworks.
Cool. Excited to hear more about that in time. All right. Joe Cohen from Infinite Machine, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world. Tim, what do you got for me this week?
I've got Porsche, and specifically Porsche's wireless charging. This was kind of a piece of news that flew under the radar a couple of weeks ago, and it's actually really cool. So the Porsche Cayenne Electric, their new electric SUV, is going to come with, or it, there will make available wireless charging, wireless inductive charging, basically like a giant, you know, wireless charger for your phone. And so they're going to sell this pad that you can install in your garage on the floor. They're going to sell, you know, the module in the car that gets the charge from it. And basically you'll be able to drive into your garage, just leave your car there, and it'll charge level two overnight at 11 kilowatts. And I think that's super cool. This is something that, like, people have asked me about. They're like, is wireless charging possible? Like, can you just like stand in a parking space and charge like you charge your phone, or charge from a wireless road? And like, this kind of stuff has existed, but not in a consumer car that you could actually buy.
Yeah.
So I think it's gonna be really cool. Estimated, we learned from a out of spec video from our friend Kyle that at least in Europe, this function is gonna cost in total around $8,000. So I don't know if you're, I don't know if I would pay that. If you're a Porsche Cayenne owner and you're already like you're already paying like 12 grand for like leather seats or whatever, these famously expensive Porsche accessories, like sure. Yeah. What's another $8,000 for your inductive charger?
If you're buying a Cayenne, that's like money you found in your couch, you know, like you're between your cushions. So good for you. Yeah, it's one of those fascinating questions we get. Like, could we build inductive charging into more parking spaces? Could we build wireless charging along roadways?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happens if I run a wire from a clock tower and when lightning hits the clock tower and goes into the wire to my vehicle, does that recharge my battery? And that one, you know, we should try in a video sometime. Maybe you could try that, Tim. I don't want to, but you could. Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah, it'd be neat. I have a plus this week also. It's Rivian. So they had their R2 factory groundbreaking in Georgia. And like, you know, it's had some setbacks lately, thanks to the Department of Homeland Security. But like, Georgia's very, very quickly becoming this hotbed of EV and battery manufacturing. You know, there's the Hyundai Meta plant and the battery plant that's near Savannah. The Rivian factory is near Atlanta, about 75 miles east of there, I think. And yeah, it's underway. They're not going to start construction until next year. The first batches of R2s are going to be made at their standard plant in Normal, Illinois. But Rivian's moving along. And I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal. CEO RJ Scringe, who was on our podcast a few weeks ago, they asked him, you know, like, you worried about opening a factory at a time when, you know, EV tax credits are going away. And RJ is just kind of like, you know, dirt off my shoulders. He's like, I didn't start this company to plan to scale the business because of that credit. So that goes away. We're still deeply convicted on the products, deeply convicted on the technology we're building. So, yeah, cool to see from Rivian.
Yeah. Eventually that plant's going to make, they say, 400,000 EVs a year, which is
wow,
way, way more than Rivian makes right now. So we'll see if that can pan out.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network.
Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.
See you next time.